Welcome to the Amazon Legends Podcast, where we have real stories about making it big on Amazon. Our guests are CEOs of large companies and entrepreneurs who became powerful sellers, also experts specializing in helping sellers, and both former and current Amazon employees who will give us an insight from behind the scenes. Here's your host, Nick Urison.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Amazon Legends. My guest today is the kind of person you want definitely in your camp. He's what I call a kingmaker, a lifelong entrepreneur, and the owner of a VC firm. His specialty is health and wellness space. He's the owner of 26 brands and Spiral Ventures. So everybody, meet my guest, Mark Tomlin. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you for having me, Nick. I'm really excited to join this this podcast.
Well, great to have you here. You are the perfect source for me to suck all the information so that we know how to build empires, right? So tell me about your last investment, Mark.
The last investment is going to be the next great apparel brand. It's called Pacas, and it's made from a very special fabric.
So Pacas is, it rhymes with an animal, right? Is that where it comes from?
It comes from alpaca, and Pacas was the first direct-to-consumer brand that really commercialized the alpaca wool as the fabric that they use in all of their products. It's more than just socks. It's a whole array of products, scarves, and but primarily socks.
So what I want to know is really how you go about making these investments. What is the secret sauce that you see and like and say, okay, this is worth my money?
Well, it's very important to remember that not everyone is an entrepreneur. Most founders that have the DNA necessary to succeed have this tremendous drive, and they're willing to risk everything they have to make their venture successful. And by that, I mean putting in not only their own personal wealth, but also continuously running through walls to make their business successful. So I think the key ingredient to any investment in the venture space, regardless what category you're investing, if it's tech, if it's consumer brands, if it's health and wellness, if it's health in particular, like Spiral Sun Ventures is primarily focused on health and wellness products in the consumer products arena. It's all about the entrepreneur. The entrepreneur has to have that grit and that know-how and that determination to be able to go from the lows to the highs. And the lows are really, really, really low for most entrepreneurs. And, you know, not everyone is cut out for that. So founders and who they are, even if it's their first time, it's their personality traits and their, you know, and their values that allow for an investment to come from someone like me or my fund. The second most important attribute is the category and itself. Is the category big enough? Is it a niche product? If it's a niche product, we want to stay away from that. But I usually look at investing based on the blue ocean theory, which, you know, is, you know, you can go into a really, really large category, and that's generally pretty good. A large category means that there's a lot of people in that blue ocean, you know, in that blue ocean that are trying to invest in the category. But you don't want to be in the red ocean where you have tremendous competition, where everyone's, you know, nipping at your heels. It's all about price point. You want to go into the blue ocean with a very, very innovative product where you see that white space in a category where you can win. And so we are generally looking for entrepreneurs that have something different. You know, Pacas is a great example. Great entrepreneurs, two brothers, co-founded Pacas, and they are the operators. They don't come from an apparel background. They're finance guys. So they're very, very strong on finance. And they came up with a really, really interesting fabric to go into a giant category, primarily socks and apparel. And through that innovation around alpaca, they were able to create an incredibly successful direct-to-consumer business. And so that's very, very important, the blue ocean strategy going into the area of the category where there's potential white space. And then I would say, obviously, being able to understand your weaknesses and your strengths. So surround yourself by people that do things better than you. It's really, really, really important to be self-aware as a founder. You're an Amazon e-commerce expert. Most of my portfolio companies don't have that. They're primarily entrepreneurs that know how to build things at traditional, conventional retail. I would say hire the best people around you to do the things that you're good at. Pacas, for example, is extremely good at direct-to-consumer from their own website. Not so great on Amazon. They aren't experts and they need someone to come in and really help them build that brand and that business on the Amazon platform and other third-party platforms other than their own website. So I would say surround yourself by tremendously good people and don't be afraid to hire people that are better than you at certain things. One of our investments is at a company called Farmer's Fridge, which is really the first vending machine that dispenses daily made salads and healthy foods. Luke Saunders is the founder, incredible founder, has all the attributes you look for in a first-time founder. But the thing that separated him is he brought people in when he first raised his $6 million, which I was part of, and I was one of his earlier advisors. His uses of funds was really interesting to me. It wasn't only about, you know, working capital and putting more vending machines around the world. It was about putting great people in place and paying them a decent base salary with upside and equity to help him scale the business. And so first-class COO, first-class CTO, he didn't really skimp on hiring best-in-class people. And I think it's really, really important to have the capital necessary to recruit and attract first-class people to the team. And so those are three really important things that we look for from an investment standpoint. And honestly, I have to be able to align with people. A dirty little secret about me is when someone sends me a deck or a PowerPoint without me knowing who they are, I will always set up a call with that entrepreneur, that founder. I give anyone 15 minutes of my time. But I don't want to be prejudiced by the deck. I want to hear from the founder or the management team. What's their reason to believe? Why did they take this crazy risk and become an entrepreneur in an early stage company? In that 15 minutes, if there's alignment and we really understand each other, we want to take the next step and get to know each other better, that's when I'll start really digging into the deck and the financials and other parts that are really important to investing. And make sure you're prepared to really appeal to a venture group by having everything in order. Set up a due diligence room. Make it easy for me to click a link and go into a due diligence room so I don't have to ask for financials or tax returns or velocity numbers on how your product is turning. Put that all in, set it up in a due diligence room, and make it easy for me to get that information to get to a yes.
So what I'm hearing is really it's the traditional approach where it's the people. It's not really idea first. So, but what I really heard you say is it's about the founder. It's not necessarily the team, because usually I hear the first thing people say is it's the team. But you focus on the founder because the founder is the one who's going to drive this. And then you put the category, then you put the team. So that's an interesting order. But when I think about it, it makes total sense because it's the founder and the category that will attract the right kind of people, right? So so it's a very smart way to approach the priority.
Nick, I would I agree with your recap of what I just said. The founder is so important. That DNA, that risk-taking, is what made the brand great in the first place. When a company sells to a big company, in my world, a big consumer products company like a Kraft or a P&G or a Unilever or a Kellogg's or a Nestle, whoever the case may be, it's really, really important to keep that founder DNA intact. Because when you lose that, what made the brand great, oftentimes you lose the magic. Recently, Coke divested Zico. Someone I know was the founder of Zico, Mark Rampolla, and he ended up buying it back from Coke. I don't know the numbers. I'm sure he did not pay what he sold it for. But Zico didn't really work in the big under Coke's ownership. But it will work again with Mark at the helm because he has that scrappiness and he knows how to build a brand and he'll bring the brand back to what it was, what made it great in the first place. So I think founder forward thinking for us does set us apart from as a venture fund. And a lot of venture funds get a bad name because they don't think that way. You know, the first thing they want to do if things aren't going well is they want to replace the founder. We don't want to replace the founder. We want to help the founder figure things out. We may supplement the management team, you know, pieces, just like any team. You need the right team in order to succeed.
Well, I mean, the best example is the story of Steve Jobs, right? So when they took him out, that was the end of Apple. And then he had to come back. I mean, that's obviously one of the very well-known ones. But the other one is a conventional company, Starbucks. You know, it's the same situation. They actually brought him back. And I mean, you probably know the story. He shut down all the stores just to go back to the basics and train the baristas because that's what the company spirit was about. And so I actually listened to him telling the story in a small group. And he was saying that, you know, the Wall Street went crazy. The competitors heard about this and started giving all kinds of incentives for people to go into their stores because Starbucks was going to be closed. So going back to the basics, that's the kind of stuff that the founder does because other people, they don't have that connection with what the company is about, right?
No question. It's usually where the innovation comes from. Many years ago, I was invited to a board meeting, a strategic meeting with a very, very large consumer products company. And I didn't really know what to say. What was I going to tell this multi-billion dollar Fortune 500 company that they were doing right or wrong or how they compete with some of the international players that came into the category? I'm not going to name the name of the company. I had about a week to prepare. And so I started looking up the history of the company. And the company was founded in the late 1800s. And it had incredible inventions. You know, it started out as a bike company and then led them to a dozen incredible inventions within that category. And so what I did for the meeting is I didn't really say anything. I just created, I had a company, I don't remember the name of the company, create a timeline for me from when the company started and what it was called then in the late 1800s to what it was today. And it was amazing to me that innovation really stopped in 1970. This meeting was in 2006. And then they just started acquiring companies and brands. And it said to me that big companies have to continue to constantly innovate. And once they stop innovating, they risk the possibility of becoming extinct. And so for that company, all you had to look at is when they stopped inventing things and disruptors within their category to make them a leader. And that's what American entrepreneurship is all about. And that's why the founder is so important. Some of these founders can be crazy and hard to deal with, but you want that magic that they have from an innovation standpoint. And that's why the founder investment thesis is so important to me.
Yes, I came across this video clip the other day. It's about, I don't remember his name, but he's an older gentleman. He's a hotshot in finance business. So he says, I knew Steve Jobs. He was an SOB. I know Elon Musk. I don't know him personally, but I know him. He's not easy to work with. I know Bill Gates. He's terrible. You see the pattern here? So I have a question for you. So you put the emphasis on the founder. And being a founder, being an entrepreneur, these are not easy things because you are alone. You are really alone with your vision. That's the definition of it. You have a vision and you want to do something and you have to communicate that to other people. But it can get pretty rough and pretty lonely pursuing that vision. What do you advise those founders who start questioning themselves? Because, you know, not everybody has somebody like you writing checks right from the get-go, right? They have to get there first. And that's a struggle because they have to be able to pay their bills, savings run out. And as you know, money runs out much faster than the results come in. So what do you advise founders to stay on course? What is the best way to keep going? Or when do they say, no, this is it?
The latter is a really an interesting question. When to say no, it's not right. I had a first-time founder come to me the other day in a sector I don't love. I don't love investing in restaurants, but he is an incredible product, very, very smart, capable young founder. And he's operating a food truck and he's thinking about raising money. But he has another job. I don't want a founder that isn't all in. And I've told him, I said, you know, you have an incredible product. When you decide to leave your other job and go all in on this business and make it more than just a hobby, then you can come and talk to me. Otherwise, I'll just continue to be a fan. But he doesn't want to take the risk of being a true founder and entrepreneur. I would say that if the founder isn't capitalized and the prospects of capitalization aren't there, there's a flaw in their plan. There's a flaw in their business plan. And unless they can self-fund and continue to self-fund and they're willing to do that, at some point, if there's no prospect of outside capital to really help the company grow, you know, you should really rethink what you're doing. Or think of a pivot. You know, is there another company that has a platform that can really help you monetize your company, your opportunity? And there's quite a few opportunities like that when you really think about. You may have a great idea. You just don't have the ability to execute on it because you don't have the resources to do it. It's okay if you no longer own 100% of your company and you have someone that can really scale it and your cap table looks very, very different. You have a license or you have a royalty stream or you have a smaller equity stake. If someone else is taking it from $1 million to $100 million, you don't own 100%, but you own 10%. I would say you have to look at that very, very hard and make a decision on what you need to do as an entrepreneur. And that's a great exit for you, and it allows you to go and find your next venture that may indeed attract outside capital. The story of Paca's, for example, prior to the pandemic, if you look at our portfolio, there's another brand in there called Gex. Gex is a antimicrobial sock, no-show sock that you stick into your shoe, and it takes away odor because it's woven with silver. It was doing extremely well prior to the pandemic. And it was, again, only sold on their website. So it was no Amazon, no other third-party platforms. And then the pandemic happened, and their key customers are primarily women that want to wear their shoes and don't want the stink to go with it. Well, it plummeted during the pandemic because people weren't putting their dress shoes on. So Pacas actually came out of, you know, of a pivot for that company, where they said, they came to the two investors, my fund, Spiral Sun Ventures and Corazon, and they said, we have another idea. We think it can work, and we think it's a better product for this time and place. And so they pivoted, and Gex is still around. We're currently looking at a potential exit there with someone that has more bandwidth and resources to take it to the next level. Two young founders that decided that in order to survive, they had to dramatically change their destiny. And when they did that, you know, we ended up putting us and a group of investors, you know, $5 to $6 million of new capital into Pacas. So I would just say you really have to assess where you are and how you need to get there. And sometimes you can get there with someone else. So, you know, think of a license, think of a potential sale, think of a joint venture, think of a way to monetize it if you don't have the resources internally.
Well, this is a question. I have an interesting story about this. So we have in entrepreneur, I belong to an organization called EO, Entrepreneurs Organization. So we have a saying, entrepreneurs are unemployed. We can't work anywhere. We don't make good employees because we don't like taking instructions. So the point is, one of the fellow members at the time, this is going way back, he used to be in hedge funds. And this is before the financial meltdown. And he was flying around the world in private jets. He had a tremendous life. So what happens? Then the whole financial meltdown happens. And now he's out of a job. But really, his was not a job. So he says, well, I know all these ventures that I've been funding. I'm going to take one of them myself and build it. So he decided to become an entrepreneur. So one day he's supposed to present about a particular issue he's having with the operation. And we always had presentations. So every month we would have a couple of us present. And whenever there is a presentation, one of the other members coaches the person. So in this case, we went two of us. And one of the methods we use is we ask the question why 7 times to get to the root cause of the issue. So you know what happened, Mark? In the conversation, right at the end, he said, you know what? I don't want to do this anymore. It's not about the problem he had at the time. It's just, you know, he just did not want to be an entrepreneur because he was not an entrepreneur. He says, I have contacts. I can get back in the game. I can do this. I was making so much money. Plus, he had, I believe he had 3 kids. And so he said, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. So that DNA of an entrepreneur is key. And you have to have that DNA. And then my response to the question I put to you, when do you say that's it? My response is never. Because if you have that entrepreneur spirit, the answer is not to give up. It's pivot. You said it, pivot. An entrepreneur keeps pivoting all the way to the end. And I'm sure even after they go 6 feet under, they still keep pivoting. So that's what we do.
I totally agree. I really appreciate that story. The why, I may steal that from you. The 7 whys, ask why 7 times.
Yeah.
It's really the important question. You know, why, and you know, if it's not working, how are you going to get back to the why?
Yeah.
Really important. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, my pleasure. It's so for those listeners, I mean, this is a very philosophical discussion, but really philosophy is what drives our actions, right? So where do you stand? What is your position? So I cannot emphasize everything you said more, you know, just believe in your vision and then look at the data. And if the data says you are getting into, or you are, your space is becoming too crowded, it's not making enough money, margins are shrinking, don't even think about quitting or anything like that. Just look at where the opportunity is and just pivot ASAP. And that's the response. That's in constant fighting. So this is great. So let's now move on to the Amazon aspect of it. So as the person who really values the money in anything, because that's what you are doing, you're putting money as your product to bring more of it. So how does Amazon factor into that valuation? And how important is it today for a private label to have that Amazon component?
Yeah, it's so important. You know, the retail landscape's changed tremendously. Consumer behavior has changed in how they perceive buying things online on Amazon versus going into the store. There's certain, you know, people are still going to go to conventional grocery. In my world, it's mostly grocery and those channels of trade. But it's also Amazon has changed the way early stage companies and consumer products can build and scale. In many cases, I'd rather see an Amazon business or direct to consumer business first before you try to fight the fight on shelf at Whole Foods or Kroger or Albertsons or whatever the major grocery is. Sometimes it's better because you really get to understand who the consumer is. You can sample products better. You can get feedback better. It's incredibly important. There are certain categories that are more challenging than others. You know, for example, a brand that I owned and then had brought to my fund as an investor is called Slice Soda. It's a reinvention of the old brand that was, you know, a billion plus in revenue. We took out all the sugar. So instead of 55 grams of sugar, it now has no added sugar and, you know, 15 to 20 calories. And we're looking at, you know, online Amazon versus conventional retail. We would need someone that really understands how to navigate Amazon with a beverage that, you know, where you're shipping water, because freight gets really significantly high. Advertising, you know, someone like me, I would depend on an expert to really help us. But as far as creating an Amazon business, even for a brand like Slice and the reinvention of Slice, getting a consumer to taste it and understand, you know, this isn't the Slice that you grew up with. This is a healthier version of it. The education of the consumer is so much easier on a platform like Amazon than it is just sticking it on a shelf at Whole Foods and expecting a consumer to understand what the change of the product was. So from a marketing standpoint, from a sampling standpoint, from a data standpoint, from a community building standpoint, Amazon is incredibly important to the success of a brand. As an investor, I would say that it's paramount that all of my portfolio companies, not only if they can't do it internally, hire an outside group to really build the Amazon presence, because it's also going to create a halo effect, not only to your own website, but to support the brand on shelf at conventional retail. So, really, 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 really important.
Yeah, this is a key question, because especially brands that have a supply chain, they struggle with that decision, because if they go on Amazon and start selling directly to consumer, now they are competing with their own resellers. So they say, no, we're not going to do that. In fact, I know a company, the founder was a guest on this podcast, and they gave, they struggled. It was a great product, came out of incredible struggle, but they believed in the product, and but still they're not doing it directly. They have their resellers, and they rely on the resellers because they don't want to compete with their resellers. So it's like, you know, we don't want to do this because we're selling to our resellers. Now, if we go there, then we're going to upset them and lose that revenue stream. So it's a difficult decision to make. Timing is important, but you have to make that. It's at some point you're going to have to do it. And you put it exactly, you know, you have more data, you have a community. Plus, this is another thing that people don't think about. Let's say that you have your, let's say you're not selling on Amazon, but you're selling through your website. In order to bring traffic to your website, you're going to spend a lot of money. And you'll spend money on Google. You'll spend money wherever. So as long as you keep spending on those paid ads, traffic will keep coming. The minute that you say, okay, I'm done, I don't want to do this anymore, that traffic goes away, unless you have a really strong remarketing program that brings those people back to make another purchase, which is hard because people have different choices. All that investment you put into online advertising for your website, gone. But that's not the case with Amazon. So even if, let's take the worst case scenario in terms of spending money, let's say that you spend money on Google to drive traffic to your Amazon listing. You're paying Amazon commission on every sale, plus you're paying the advertising cost. That still has a tremendous residual value because every single sale you bring, it will rank up your listing. And then that rank going up will get you organic traffic. So in fact, I have a guest. The opening line, I asked him, so tell me something you're doing really well right now. And he said, well, we make money by losing money. I said, well, how is that? I mean, when you lose money, it's gone, right? He says, well, yeah, we lose money on advertising. But that advertising dollars bring traffic, which basically is all about people who want to buy, not just visitors looking at information. And that will rank up the listing. And then, you know, you're going to get organic traffic in the long run. When you stop the advertising or reduce it, the sales will still keep coming because now you've gained. So that's the advantage of Amazon. Plus, for brands, Amazon is offering all kinds of benefits. For example, there is something called brand referral bonus. What that means is if you spend money on Google, bring traffic to your listing, and generate, let's say, $100,000, depending on the category, but generally what I see is 10%. Amazon pays you back 10% of the total revenue you generate from Google advertising because they want external advertising to come, external traffic to come to Amazon. So there are all kinds of reasons why it's better to do this ASAP than delay it. So, and I'm glad that... As an investor, you want the same.
You need the same. Traditional, conventional retail, both the natural channel and the conventional channel, to get on shelf at a brand with a brand, you have, you know, it's a lot of capital to do that. And when you factor in a lot of the conventional retailers have these things called slotting fees, so you're basically paying for the real estate on shelf. So there's cost in doing things in conventional, traditional that are significant to an early stage, you know, brand. And then you, because in the beverage category, for example, you know, the big companies are all direct store delivery or DSD. You know, so the smaller brands are forced to put their brands on other people's trucks. Very, very, very expensive, very challenging from a distribution standpoint. So if I were to compare the cost of getting on shelf at a major grocer versus a, you know, a launch on Amazon in conjunction with your other e-commerce direct-to-consumer initiatives, I would always probably, and this isn't true 10 years ago, but today I would always say, let's build it here first. Let's understand who our customer is. Let's truly build a community of fans and people that really love the product. And then when you go to a Walmart or you go to a Target or you go to a Kroger or you go to an Albertsons, you say, listen, here's, you know, we have this incredible five-star reviews, our customers love it. This will add incremental value to the category. You know, you put it on shelf, you already have this fan base that will go into store to buy it. And it, you know, at the end of the day, I need to do the math to understand what's more important, but the brand building alone, even if I don't make a penny, is crucial to the success of the brand. I don't want to lose money like your other guest. Yeah. That's not in my vocabulary, but I'm okay spending money to gain consumers and data and then making it more successful on shelf at conventional retail.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. So there's this agreement between Amazon and Google. When somebody goes on Google and does a search for a brand, Amazon serves up the product results. So
that's great.
If you are not on Amazon as a brand, and let's say that you take the conventional route and then you go to one of these department stores, grocery store, or whatever the chain, and then you're pitching it to the buyer, what do you think the buyer is going to do? He's going to Google you and you don't even come up anywhere. You know, what does it say, right? So you've got to be on Amazon. You have to start there and then collect customer feedback, understand what the customer thinks your product does, not you, but what the customer thinks, and then test the price points, test the variations. That's another thing that I say. You know, it may be hard for you to make money by selling, let's say, for example, singles, then create a two-pack, create a three-pack, whatever. I mean, that's the first thing I do with my clients. I look at they come to me, okay, keyword, advertising, and I said, hold on, stop. Let's look at the revenue model. Says, what do you mean? We know our numbers. I said, no, let me see it. And then often, you know, it comes out that I actually built something, it color codes. Everything has to come out green. And there are like three different costs associated with the sale, and run different scenarios with promotion, give this coupon, that, give that coupon. It has to come out green. And then they come out all red. At best, they come out yellow. I say, no, your model is broken. What do you mean? Well, imagine you're getting 1,000 orders a day. That's a great thing to achieve, right? It says, yeah. Well, you'll never have any money in your pocket. Why do you want to do this? So it's always like that.
See, I learned from you, and hopefully you learned a little bit from me as a guy that can pick up the phone and call the right distributors and retailers to give a brand or a product a chance. Like I said before, retail has changed. I remember a meeting with one of our portfolio companies, and they were so happy. They got into roughly 15,000 doors, and they were still, you know, they had just created their new product. And I said, okay, so how are you going to support 15,000 doors? And what happens if it doesn't turn on shelf? We need more money. Well, most investors are going to wait to see how it turns before they put in the necessary money. So a smaller launch to understand your consumer, if it's Amazon or a smaller footprint at a place like Walmart, we have 250 stores rather than all of their stores, I would always recommend that. You know, you don't want to put the gas on a business too quickly because you're going to find out very, very soon that you're going to have to continue to fuel the beast. And that's very, very expensive, and you will lose money doing that.
So, Mark, I want to ask you, so you make these investments, you've been doing this long enough, and what is the exit of the investor? What are you looking to do? What is the timeline? How do you decide what that's going to be?
It's a great question. I mean, typically it's a 3 to 5 year timeline. My fund is not a conventional fund. It probably surprises you as an entrepreneur. I didn't create a fund that is conventional. So we have a little bit more of a longer horizon. We operate more like a family office. where we want to roll up our sleeves, truly roll up our sleeves, and help these founders succeed. You know, it is interesting when a founder or when a prospective portfolio company, someone that we're interested in investing, we do background checks and we get to know who they are as people. I always tell them, call our portfolio companies to get references on us. And if we aren't helping, what's the point? You know, we really, truly need to be able to demonstrate that we can lean in and help these companies. That's another criteria that we have. If we don't believe we can help, then we're not going to invest. And there have been a couple of examples of that where we loved the entrepreneur and loved the company, but we didn't feel that we had the expertise to really lean in and help them figure out how to get to the next level of their business. I don't know if that answered your question, Nick, but
the part that I want to know is, what are you looking as a return? What is a good return for you on your investment?
Well, I'd love to. One of my partners always says we look for a 10x. Well, of course, everyone looks for a 10x, but the reality is that's not the norm. We're always looking, you know, minimum, you know, we want to see a return on our money, and that could be a 2x rather than a 10x. But unlike tech in the food world, especially in what we do with the emerging brands, you don't have one, you know, company that's going to make up losses on everyone else. So I'm a kid from Boston, Nick. So I use a Boston Red Sox player as a reference point. We have to have a Ted William average. We can't be below the Mendoza line, you know, below 200. We have to have 4 out of 10 that are, you know, singles, doubles, maybe a triple, maybe a grand slam. But we can't depend on one crazy portfolio company to make up losses for all of the other portfolio companies. So we are very diligent in making sure that these companies have a potential exit, even if it's a single, even if it's a double, even if it's the example of Gex I gave earlier, which this Paca's founders pivoted. Gex will have an exit, but it won't be the 10x that we're looking for. But it's a nice little business that another platform and another group will take and nurture and hopefully succeed on, but we'll stay involved in that. So singles, doubles, triples, they're all going to happen. There'll be a few strikeouts as well. Hopefully that's not too many. But we're looking for, you know, somewhere between, you know, a 3 to 5x on average. And we're hoping for 10 X's.
Yeah. I mean, it's because, you know, you're making investments, you're taking risk. So obviously you want to get the highest return, but it's not always possible. So you really are an unusual kind of a venture capital operation, because I know so many, I met so many. Usually they are in, they are out in 2 years, to maybe 3 years. They don't say 3 to 5. They always say, you know, 10x. That's what we're looking for, because they say, well, 1 out of 10 will really make it. Well, because we're gonna lose on so many, that's why we have to look for that 10x. So that's not, you are basically putting quality ahead of quantity and then try to maximize on each one. It's a different approach I see here.
It's a different approach, and plus we're trying to be impactful. If you look at our portfolio companies, a lot of them have missions. A lot of them, I think 50% of our founders are women. A lot of venture money, unfortunately, doesn't go to women founders. It's more and more rare. We didn't try to purposely invest in women founders. We just found that at the end of the day, when we looked at our portfolio, that over half of them were women. And it's really, really important that that our portfolio companies are doing something that's meaningful to hopefully change the world in a better way. Certainly change people's eating habits from eating too much processed food to eating better natural foods. I think that's really, really important for my own legacy and hopefully my kids and my family and future generations appreciate that.
Yeah, I hear that your purpose is to make an impact, really. Venture capital, yeah, or otherwise, that's the business you are in, to make an impact. So tell us about Mark Tomlin. Who is Mark Tomlin? Where do you live? And tell us about your passions.
You know, about 8 years ago, I got sick, and that thankfully, sometimes just like we were talking about founders having to pivot, sometimes when you're at your low, it can result in your high. And so what happened to me when I got sick is it really changed my perspective on how I wanted to live my life, how I wanted to be a dad, how I wanted to be a husband, and how I wanted to be an entrepreneur. And, you know, I still have my other businesses that take these dormant brands and relaunch them. And that's where I became relatively well known. But it was at that point in my life that I wanted a legacy that, you know, was more about putting better food in people's pantries and on their table. I attributed my health issue to the way I was eating, and I was eating too much processed bad food. And so it really changed how I wanted to spend my time and how I wanted to invest my money. And so that's when, you know, six, seven years ago that I started investing personally in things like Farmer's Fridge and indoor farming and things that really had a tremendous impact on our food system in a positive way. And Spiral Sun really came out of that belief that I wanted to, and other people around me, our LPs are all very successful people that shared the same belief that they wanted to have an impact on our food system and take these emerging brands with better for you products, especially in food, and make them more successful by adding capital and people to them.
So your situation actually gave you almost like a rebirth.
It really did. And you know, thankfully I've been, my health is all good now. But for me, even when I got sick, I didn't put my head down and mope. And, you know, I didn't want people to know I was sick at the time. It was evident if you saw me. But for me, I put my head down. I stayed on boards. I worked as hard as I did prior to getting sick, but I knew I wanted to live my life a little differently. And, you know, we had lived in Chicago for many, many years. And in January of this year, we actually moved to Raleigh, North Carolina, for no other reason than just to change our lifestyle. And our kids, you know, went to public schools in the Chicago, city of Chicago, and taking them here and moving here for the three of them was a very positive move just to, you know, slow down a little bit. Not that Raleigh's slower, it's just a different lifestyle than living in the city.
Well, you know, you applied your own formula to yourself when you got sick. You know what that is, right? You pivoted.
I pivoted. I personally pivoted, and you know, it's always work. I mean, you know, I said earlier that I'm hopefully a better father and a better husband. That's work, you know, but you always have to continuously remind yourself, you know, that you got a second chance to do it right.
Yeah. And you pivoted by moving. So where do you think this, because I mean, I believe in the concept of pivoting. That's the only way, but it doesn't come natural to a lot of people. To you, it seems like it comes natural. So where do you think that comes from? Is that something that, did you move around when you were growing up as a kid?
Yeah, my father was a diplomat. So I went to many different high schools, many different elementary schools.
Okay.
And it was really important that I got, in order to meet people, you know, I was meeting people every 2 years, essentially. So I had to make new friends. And I was an athlete, so that made it easier. Because if you're good at something, you know, other kids are like, yeah, he can, he's cool. I think that's really where, it stems from, is that, I had to understand, how people operated and how best to become part of a community and be accepted. And I do think that probably shaped how I am today as an entrepreneur and how I pivot and how I'm able to adapt to new situations. So thank you, Dad and Mom.
Well, I mean, look, you know, this is it. I mean, you find that you are in your own element, so to speak, when it's time to change, because change is very hard for a lot of people, especially moving. So people don't like that. They want to be doing the same thing. So, but to you, it comes naturally. And that's because that's been put into your DNA. That's what you've done growing up as a kid. And so I'm going to actually tell you something else. You may know about it already, but maybe not, because most people, they've never heard. Are you familiar with the term third culture kid?
Third culture, that's new. I can guess what it means, but I have never heard that before.
Well, TCK for short. So look it up a little bit. For anybody listening, you may find yourself to be a TCK. So TCKs are people who spend more of their adult years outside their parents' culture. So typically, these are kids who are military brats or diplomats, or basically parents move around because of their career a lot. So these kids find themselves every other year losing friends, making new friends, losing friends, making new friends. So they develop the kind of personality that is very different than your regular people. So that is the nature of TCKs. And TCKs have funny characteristics. For example, they have about 3 to 4 time zones set up on their computer because they have people all over the world and are in different time zones. So they want to stay connected. So they set the time zones up on their computer. They start to receive birthday greetings before their birthday, because somebody in a different time zone, you know, it's several hours ahead. So
I get it. It's definitely me. No question about it. I thank you for that.
Look it up. The first time I happened to be a TCK, and I used to think, and another thing is, if you ever ask a TCK, where are you from? They struggle with that question, because they do not identify with one particular place, and they have this love-hate relationship. How am I going to answer? They become confused. They feel bad. I was like that. People ask, where are you from? And people answer very easily, very comfortably. They own it. They own the answer. I never had that. And I would think that something is wrong with me. And then somebody said one day, just like I said to you, you are a TCK. And then I said, well, what do you mean? She said, look it up. And then when I read about it, I thought, oh my God, this is like lights totally went up. And I thought, this makes now total sense.
Makes total sense. I mean, most every Thanksgiving growing up, my father and mother always would invite guests from a different culture, because Thanksgiving is a very American holiday. Sure. And we had people from all around the world. It was their very first Thanksgiving, and would be in places like Milan or Geneva or McLean, Virginia. It was one of the places I lived probably the longest in the States. And we always maintain a home in Boston. So I do tell people I'm originally from Boston, but I actually didn't live there as long as some of the other places. So I always needed a home base. But yeah, your definition there is accurate. And it was great. When we moved overseas for the first time, I was upset at first because I didn't want to leave my culture, my American friends. It ended up being perhaps the best part of my informal education when we did make the move and we lived overseas in Milan. And even though I went to an American school, I was one of the very few Americans in the school. So it was as if I was going to an Italian school.
Yeah, that's great. So, it always adds up. It's everything is all in the childhood. And then, it suddenly turns into these major successes in life. So Tell us, Mark, how people can reach you. Give us the contact information. We'll obviously put that on our website, and we'll also on YouTube, where, together with your episode. How can people reach you?
Mark at spiralsunventures.com. My contact information, it's easy to get. If you request a meeting, just use my Calendly link that I'll send you. And like I said before, happy to meet new people, happy to hear new ideas. I certainly enjoy mentoring and hopefully, you know, broadening my own network by meeting people that make my brain more active, and hopefully I can impart a tiny bit of wisdom on them. But yeah, Mark at Spiral Sun Ventures is the best place to start. You can certainly, you know, friend me on LinkedIn. That's I do use that. I stopped accepting some invitations of people I don't know, but just put your put the fact that you heard me on this podcast in the note, and I'll accept you.
Great. Thank you very much, Mark. This was great. I definitely learned a lot from you about approaching, you know, venture capital, but really about what matters the most. I think most our listeners will appreciate that very much. Thank you again.
So, thank you.
So that brings us to the end of another episode, and I'll see you on the next one.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode. Be sure and subscribe, rate, and review our show. And be sure and share an episode with a friend. And thank you so much for being with us today. We'll see you next week here on Amazon Legends.